Welcome to Ugeria, broadcasting live from Business Radio X Studios. Ugeria is a Greek word meaning health of body and mind in aging individuals. Ugeria Radio is a weekly show celebrating the heroes that contribute to the Ugeria of our elderly and disabled population. Now joining us in the studio are your hosts, Sam Grass and Brad Culp.
Good morning. This is Sam Grass in Atlanta, Georgia. Joining me today in the studio is Lee Cantor, our producer. Good morning, Lee.
Good morning, Sam. How are you feeling?
I'm doing great. Also in the studio today is Dr. Tom Price. Dr. Price is on the staff of the Emory University School of Medicine. We will get to him a little later. But also in Dallas, Texas is Brad Culp and Kevin Ritz. Are you all there?
We're here. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you today?
We're doing terrific. It's a beautiful sunny day in Dallas.
Well, I miss you in Atlanta, Brad, but I'll hand it off to you and take it away.
Oh, you're not going to give us any trivia or anything this morning?
That's your responsibility. You know that. We've been doing this now for almost 2 years.
Well, we're just going to get right into it this morning. Got Kevin here with me, and we are with Alex Namath this morning. At his business, which is Friends Place of McKinney, and I'm going to let him introduce himself, but he and his wife Barb are the owners of this company. And good morning, Alex.
Good morning, Brad. Good morning, Kevin.
Thanks for giving us an opportunity to chat with you this morning.
Well, love the opportunity as well. Thanks for coming and visiting the site.
Let's just kick this off the way we typically do. If you could just give us a little bit of background on yourself, where you're from, your education, and how you came to be where you are today.
Okay, be glad to. So my roots are not native Texas, so the snowstorms didn't impact me personally as much as it did everybody else, because I'm from Detroit. So I had 40 years of experience driving on ice-covered roads and driving among other drivers that knew how to drive within those conditions, which is very different down here. So having been raised in Michigan, one of the great universities there is Michigan State University. So in fact, I went there and graduated from Michigan State with actually a degree in social work way back in 1972. So I've been around and been on this earth for a while. The career, Brad and Kevin, for me, really didn't lead me down the road of social work. I ended up, after coming out of college, finding out that social work really didn't pay very well. Even, and my friends had all moved into sales and actually got into early technical and IT sales. So my career really went along the path of large technology companies, working for IBM, working for Digital Equipment Corporation, and Novell as well, and had a very successful 30-year run in the technology business. And ultimately leading to this, which is another story we'll discuss.
Excellent. So 30 years in technology sales, and suddenly you're on business.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to make sense, does it? At least not on the cover anyways. But so here's the rest of the story, and I think all of us have a similar story. That's why we're in healthcare. We've all been personally affected, typically within the family or even personally, with some problem relating to health and health care. And we experienced that same thing here. So a couple years ago, my dad came down, was diagnosed. Well, first his wife was diagnosed with Alzheimer's living up in Detroit. He took care of her. She ultimately succumbed from it. And then he came down with Alzheimer's shortly thereafter. And being an only child then, it was clearly my responsibility to take care of my dad as I would want to, but I couldn't do it long distance. Trying to configure his pills into the pill box over the phone was pretty difficult. So we made the transition. We put Dad on an airplane at 89, the first time he'd ever been on a plane in his life. We brought him down here. He wouldn't live with us, but we did move him to assisted living. Cognitively, he was not too bad. But one of the frustrations we had while he was living in assisted living was finding something for him to do, some kind of activities, because we knew stimulation of the mind and the body was extremely important in slowing down the progression of the disease. Without that available, unfortunately, he did live for 3 years down here in assisted living, ultimately going into skilled nursing care and ultimately dying about a year and a half ago then from Alzheimer's and vascular dementia. So that was certainly a huge impact on my life and my wife's life as well. At the same time, you know, I'd lived out my 30 years in IT and thought, okay, it's time to do something else. And what could we do to sort of honor my dad and provide a care of service that, quite frankly, isn't readily available to seniors today? And that's that care of service from living at home to ultimately going to placement. What can we do for them for that interim period of time? And that's how we got involved in this.
So tell us a little bit about Friends Place. Mm-hmm. I know you're not the founder, so tell us a little bit about, first of all, I guess, what is it? What, sure. What is Friends Place? And then, you know, how did you get involved with, mm-hmm. with the founder and ultimately end up owning this office?
Very good. Great question, Brent. So as my wife and I went out there, we talked to all the healthcare professionals, people like yourselves, to figure out if there was a slice of care not being addressed. Everybody said home health got it covered, right? There's a lot of people out there doing it today, both medical and non-medical. So ultimately, people led us to Friends Place, which is located down in Richardson. Pam Kovacs is the founder and owner, and she had built the facility up over a 5.5-year period. She's been in business for a long time, had that vision probably 7 or 8 years ago that there was a need for this sort of service. So as chance would have it, we went down and talked to Pam. We were interested in the model. We looked at franchise opportunities, but we're particularly interested in that. At that time, Pam was looking to expand her brand. We were looking to build something up in McKinney, which is our, you know, rapidly growing area, but also an elderly population moving down here to be with their kids that had moved down here because of jobs, and then came to an agreement. So, Brad, it was probably about a year and a half ago that we first started talking. It took another 6 months for us to figure out how we could work together. Then it took us almost a year through the whole process of finding location, build out, training, and then learning exactly what we wanted to deliver to our clients.
So tell us exactly what is Friends Place, what do you do, and what services do you provide?
That's perfect. So the services we provide, and our mission really is providing services for early dementia, Alzheimer's, or other adults with memory care issues. And they are adults. It's not necessarily that they have a diagnosis, but they typically all have memory care issues. And we provide them on a day service basis, so there's no overnight here. They come in, and you might look at it certainly as an activity center, but everything has been designed therapeutically, both socially and physical. So from the carpet to the colors of the walls to the foods that we serve to the activities that we run, they're all done with the intent that we're going to help slow the progression of this disease for these people and give them back a purpose in life. What we find oftentimes, Brad and Kevin, is that the only thing they have to live for is the TV. Oftentimes, Brad, the call we'll get is from the frantic caregiver that's been providing support to their loved one 24/7 and can't do it any longer.
Right.
You know, they were never set up to do that nor be trained to do that. We take that off their hands, and those individuals then come to us. Some come one day a week, many come two, some three, and some come 5 days a week. They come for 5 hours or 8 hours a day.
And so do you sit down and design a plan for each individual, or are they coming in to participate in group activities? Or?
That's a great question. So obviously we do an analysis and assessment up front. We also have a full-time nurse on staff. We are licensed by the state of Texas under DADS, so those requirements are all met and in place today. After the assessment, we do a health assessment, but we also do a mental or cognitive assessment as well, as just general interests. So once we've done that, then we then group the people together according to those interests and cognitive capabilities. So there are always multiple activities going on at the same time. Just as you saw the group break just now, there are about 15 people in the dining room. Some portion of that group went up to the front conference room to do a mind strengthening exercise. Another group went to a more physical activity because that's what they could appreciate. And another group, I think, is doing some flower arranging. And we know that, again, based on their experience with us and their interests as well.
Now, you've been open for how long?
We opened up in late September.
Late September. So you're coming up to 5-6 months here.
We are.
Um, Do you have any stories yet of how people have been impacted by what you do?
Great stories. You know, and you couldn't be in this business if you weren't rewarded by your clients. You know, at the end of the day, obviously you have to make money to keep the doors open. But at the end of the day, when the client comes back and says, oh my gosh, my husband for the first time was out throwing the football with his grandson, and he hasn't done that in years. Or I got the client that comes back and they start with 1 day and 2 days, 3 days, and then 5 days because they see the difference. It's the client that wakes up at 5 o'clock in the morning shaking the spouse out of bed to say, is it time to go yet? Those are the kind of stories that we hear repeatedly from our caregivers. And the beauty of the model is that it's a benefit for both the caregiver and for the client, too, because now we're giving their life back, too. So they've got that precious 5 hours or 8 hours or whatever time you signed up for to go back and do some of the things that they used to do and try to get their life back in order a little bit, right? Typically, you know, spouses aren't together all day long. So we kind of provide that back as well for them.
How is this paid for? Is this purely private pay? Is there any assistance available for the services you provide?
Mm-hmm. Good question. It's a private pay. However, and there's a lot of smart people out there that have invested in long-term health care insurance. And some of my folks bring in these old dusty policies and say, Alex, what do you think? And so far, I can't tell you it's 100%, but every one that we process the claim for is in fact paid on. Long-term health insurance sees it as an opportunity to keep, again, their customer out of long-term health care facilities, which obviously are a lot more expensive than they would be provided, you know, using the services that we provide.
So this is you have a nurse here. Is this a non-medical service, or are there any skilled services provided, or is it purely non-medical?
Yeah, I mean, we're going to provide medication if required for those. We'll do blood pressure checks. We'll do glucose monitoring. But it's really just a small fraction even of what the nurse does.
Sure.
The nurse is with the clients in those activities and assisting us.
Okay. You provide meals here. You got a full kitchen, I think, right?
Yeah, you should see that thing, Brad. I had to invest an arm and a leg in that because the state and the city required it, even though it's technically called a warming kitchen.
Yes.
You'll see the $5,000 freezer, refrigerator, and convection oven. But that's really an important component of the activity.
You talked about preparing food that was designed for the type of services you provide. I think you specifically said designed to help slow the process.
Sure.
Progression of the Alzheimer's. Jesus. What does that mean?
Well, for us, that means, first of all, that a dietitian has to approve our menus. So they are balanced meals, so it's not a full sugar content. It's not carbo content. It's balanced within each of the items that are delivered during the course, you know, of the meal. And they are varied such during the course of the month as well to give them that variety. And what we find is this almost becomes their most nutritious meal of the day. Mm-hmm. And the lunch component is an important part of the day because it's also a socialization process.
Yeah.
It's not unusual, Brad, for one of the guys to lean over and tell one of the ladies, hey, I'm picking up the tab today. All right, so obviously that's all taken care of. But the whole facility, while you can't see it on the phone, it's made to look much like a country club, a very non-clinical environment to make them, again, feel comfortable that it's really just an extension of their living room and their home and what they're comfortable and familiar with.
Yeah, I can see how it could be the healthiest meal of the day because a lot of these seniors don't want to prepare a meal.
That's right.
I mean, I don't want to prepare a meal when I'm home by myself. So it's much easier to pull something out of the freezer or warm it up in the microwave. So I can certainly see how that would be the case. What surprised you in this whole process? I know you and I have talked over the months as you prepared to open. And what was your biggest surprise?
I guess my biggest surprise, and it's my message to the world, too, is that oftentimes people are waiting longer than they should, the caregiver, in taking care of their loved one, whether it's the child taking care of the parent or the spouse taking care of the other spouse. And oftentimes, like I mentioned, the call I get from the frantic caregiver or in fact the person with the disease is so far along that our ability to really help them is marginalized if they had been here sooner. So then what I hear from the caregiver is, geez, I wish I would have known about you earlier.
Yeah.
And it breaks my heart because you're right. We could have done more for them if in fact, they were brought here earlier or we existed. And, of course, we have been here by
right.
September.
That's actually a pretty good segue into the point in the show where we always ask somebody mm-hmm. for a bit of advice for our listeners. So, maybe it's that or maybe it's tuning that a bit. But, for our listeners that are struggling with the day-to-day caregiving of a loved one, what advice would you offer up to them?
Yeah, so I think, first of all, get a diagnosis. If you're suspicious that something's going on, that it's more than just, I can't find my car keys, but you find the car keys in the freezer, those are the kind of signs that you're looking for that it may be more than just getting older. So get that diagnosis. There are medications out there today. Again, they won't cure the disease. They do help, in fact, slow down the progress of the disease. And talk to your doctors. Doctors are becoming more aware of services like our own, the day services, to get the people stimulated both socially and physically within the facilities themselves. And, of course, as I mentioned already, is get them in here as quick as you can. You'll find out that it's a benefit both for you caregivers that are listening to this, give you your time back and your sanity, and then also our ability to be able to help your loved one as well.
Very good. Thank you. Good advice. For our listeners that would like to have more information or would like to get a tour, contact you?
Sure, a couple ways. We do have a website. It's a great one, so you want to take a look at that. It's www.friendsplaceads, on the end, which is .com. ADS is Adult Day Services. So friendsplaceads.com. You'll find both locations listed on there and more information about the programs and the activities. Or you can certainly call us direct, Barbara and myself, at 972-569-9000 right here in McKinney.
Terrific. Well, again, thank you for the opportunity to be here and chat with you on the show. And this is a beautiful place. I would urge anybody that is listening to come on up for a tour.
Very good. Thank you very much, guys.
And with that, we'll turn it back to Sam in Atlanta.
We thank you, Brad. I certainly thank Alex for being on the show. It sounds like it's a great facility, and I look forward to visiting when I'm in Dallas next time. Thanks again.
You're welcome.
Joining me today in the studio is Dr. Tom Price. Dr. Price is with the Emory University School of Medicine. He is chief of medicine for the Division of Geriatric Medicine and Gerontology. About 4 weeks ago, I had the privilege of hearing Dr. Price as the keynote speaker at a caregiver symposium, and he gave a talk entitled, Being Omitted, What to Expect When a Loved One Goes Inpatient. The information in this is vital to anyone who might be looking at an inpatient stay, just to wade through the practitioners, the language, the what I will call the gobbledygook of medicine. Great information. So what we're going to do a little bit different today is I'm going to principally turn it over to Dr. Price, allow him to give this information. I will do my best to keep my mouth shut for those out there listening, but you obviously know how difficult that is. And Lee's got something to say right now, I can tell.
Is gobbledygook, is that a professional term?
It is. It's certainly in the medical dictionaries, yes. Isn't it, Dr. Price? With that, welcome to the microphone, Dr. Tom Price.
Thank you, Sam. I'd like to talk to all of you out there about what to do when one of your loved ones, usually a parent suffering from a degenerative disease such as Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, etc., when they get sick, what do you do? Usually the first thing people do is call the doctor's office. And these days, it's a little harder to get in touch with the doctor. Sometimes you're speaking to the doctor's nurse. Sometimes you're speaking to a physician who may be covering for that physician after hours. It's kind of hard to know who you're going to talk to when you call that phone number. Let's, for sake of argument, think about as if you had an 80-year-old mother who has Alzheimer's disease who's becoming ill. And she's started throwing up for the last day. She's not eating, she's not drinking, and she looks pale. And she seems to be becoming more confused and lethargic than usual. This represents usually one of the more common scenarios people see when an older person needs to be hospitalized. The first step is, of course, you call the physician. And you call the physician's office, and instead of speaking to your normal doctor, your mother's normal doctor, you speak to a doctor who is covering for that physician after hours. And they may or may not be helpful. That's fine. But they usually say the same thing at the end. Take your mother to the emergency room. And, of course, this is something you really don't want to hear because we don't usually like to spend a lot of our time in emergency rooms. So the thing is to look at this from an orderly perspective, and I hope that through this talk you will be able to understand a little bit more about what's going on and how to handle it in a more rational, logical, possibly calmer manner. The first step to determine when you need to have your mother go to this hospital, to the emergency room, is do you take her yourself or do you call 911? If your mother is not responsive, if she's not talking, if she seems to be in distress, particularly if she's breathing more rapidly than usual, if you count the number of times she takes a breath in a minute, if it's over 20, I think you should call 911. You may not need it, but it's important to have paramedics nearby during the transfer, especially if the hospital is a significant distance. If you do decide courageously to take your mother in a car and take her to the emergency room, I strongly advise people not to drive the car. Get a friend, a relative, or your spouse to drive the car. You are needed to take care of mom. You will be sitting in the back seat with mom, trying to comfort her, and if she's throwing up, you need to be able to help her deal with that. You can't do that from the driver's seat reaching around, or else we will now have two patients to see in the emergency room, one of which may unfortunately be in the trauma bay. Once you've made the decision, contacted family or friends to help you drive to the emergency room, you need to know what you need to bring. And this is very important. You might want to have a piece of paper to write this down. The first step is to prepare the bag for your mother. The first thing to put in that bag is a Ziploc bag or larger bag full of all the medications she currently takes in their bottles. Do not dump out her little Monday through Friday prescription box, because to a physician, one white pill looks the same as another white pill. You want to have contact information for your mother's primary care physician and the other specialists she sees, particularly their names, their office phone numbers, and if possible, a fax number. This is important because the emergency room physician will ask for this information and will be able to send a report of the emergency room stay, including all the diagnostic and laboratory work, to her physician. You need to bring her insurance cards, particularly her Medicare and Medicaid card, and a proof of identification. If you have this ready, it will take a little bit of stress off of you when you realize you may not have it on you. Bring a change of clothes for her, and I recommend a tracksuit or a gym suit, something with an elastic waist that's easy to get on. There's two reasons for this. One is you want to get your mother moving when she's in the hospital, and two, you want to preserve her dignity because we all know that hospital gowns do nothing about that. Finally, please bring any dentures, glasses, or hearing aids that your mother would need. It's very important to allow her to have a comfortable hospital stay so that she's able to see things like the television or a wire on the floor that she can maybe step over. But also, she needs to be able to hear and she needs to be able to eat. When older persons who are admitted to the hospital cannot do any of those things, we call this sensory deprivation to some extent, they become more confused, and it can worsen the situation. I know that most people are worried about losing these things, but it's important to, yes, you can keep track of them, but it's important to try to keep mother oriented while she's in the hospital. Now that you've prepared your mother's bag, you have to prepare your bag. As a caregiver, you're part of the caregiver team. You are just as important as any physician or nurse that's going to be taking care of you, and you need to be prepared. You need to bring your own medications, at least a two-day supply. So if you take medications for your own medical conditions, pack them with you. You need to bring a copy of your mother's living will and or advance directive or other document such as a power of attorney. The hospital will take a photocopy of this, and if you get testy about anything, please make sure that they give you back your originals. You never know where these documents can sometimes disappear. But it's important to bring that because it will help as the situation gets worse and you have more things to worry about than looking for a piece of paper. Bring a book that will entertain you because you will be doing a lot of waiting. You will wait for her to be seen by a physician in the emergency room. You will wait for the nurse to come to her when she's in the hospital. So bring a Sudoku book, crossword book, trashy novel, whatever will keep you entertained. Bring your cell phone, and this is important, bring the cell phone's charger. I see a lot of people whose cell phones run down or their cell phone was run down when they picked it up. Just make sure to bring the charger. Bring a change of clothes for yourself. Bring some hygiene supplies. Unless you like using the travel size that the hospital sometimes provides, you may be more comfortable with your own scented shampoos or body lotions. Also, bring a snack and some water. If you anticipate a longer stay, a sandwich. But be prepared to be able to essentially sleep over. Once you have those two bags set, you're going to be going on a drive. You need to bring some things in the car. And particularly what you really need is a blanket to keep mom warm, a plastic bag in case she does have a vomiting episode, and a towel to help clean her up. Bringing water may also help as well, but is not as important since you will be going to the emergency room forthwith. Your behavior in the car is important. Be calm and say supportive things to your mother. Keep her calm. If you get upset, she will most likely get upset. Sit with her in the back seat. Don't try to coordinate from the front passenger seat. Have her in the back seat and be able to sit with her. That way you can hold her, offer your comfort, and won't have to be looking back all the time. At this point, you will have arrived at the emergency room. And you may wait. The good thing is that waiting hours are getting better these days, but they're still hours and not minutes. Once you finish triage, which is when the nurse checks you in, checks your mother's blood pressure, vital signs, get some basic insurance information, you will now go to a treatment room, and you will wait in the treatment room. You will see a number of people. You've first seen the reception clerk and the triage nurse. Well, then you will see the emergency room nurse. Then you may see a phlebotomist or other technician. You may see a physician briefly poke his head in or her head in and then disappear for another hour. And you may see another phlebotomist and another technician. And then you may see finally one of the physicians or one of the myriad physicians who may be taking care of mother when she's in the hospital. The question I get asked often is, well, what does the emergency room physician do when I only see them for 5 minutes? Well, they're spending more than 5 minutes on your mother's case. Once your mother is in the treatment room, in the emergency room, the nurse will relay information to the emergency room physician. That emergency room physician will then go on the computer system to look and see what other times your mother has been admitted, what her past medical history is, and get a better picture of what are the most likely scenarios he will be dealing with or she will. Then the doctor will come in the room, examine your mother, and then may leave after asking some more questions. This means the doctor is now going to order more diagnostic tests to help the doctor figure out what are the next steps. The emergency room physician's main job purpose is not to diagnose your mother fully and come up with the complete treatment plan for her hospital stay. It is primarily to determine, is your mother sick enough that she needs to be in the hospital or can go back home? For the purposes of this scenario, we will say that this physician makes the decision that your mother needs to go into the hospital. This decision can take anywhere from 2 to 12 hours, depending on the complexity of medical diagnostic testing that needs to be done. Some tests that are often done include blood work, CAT scan, X-ray, etc. Once the physician has made the determination that your mother needs to be admitted, you will see another physician. In a teaching hospital, this will often be an intern, who may look as young as one of your grandchildren. Be kind to this intern because he is learning, or she is learning, how to become a physician, and your mother is going to teach her how he or she can become a physician. They will ask questions. Some of them may not even seem like they're appropriate, but be patient and answer them to the best of your ability. The kicker is, now that that physician leaves, about 30 minutes to an hour later, another physician will come in. This will be the resident physician. This physician will ask pretty much the same exact questions the intern has asked, but again, be calm, be patient. They're learning how to be physicians. Your mother is going to be taken care of. Finally, there will be some movement. There will be a nurse coming in, putting a wristband on your mother, saying she is now going up to her hospital room. Depending on the type of hospital you're in, you may actually be either on a teaching service, which will be populated by an intern, a resident, and an attending physician that is in the order of seniority, ascending seniority, or you may be admitted to a single practice system, which is known as a hospitalist. Hospitalists are doctors who only take care of patients in the hospital. They usually do not have outpatient practices. They specialize in acute illnesses. Many of these physicians do not have great amount of skill dealing with chronic illnesses in the outpatient setting, but they do have an immense amount of skill handling patients with what we call acute or immediate changes in medical condition. Once you get to the hospital room, you need to also figure out what unit you're in. There are different rules for different units, and it'd be important to talk to the nurse who greets your mother on what are the rules of that unit. For example, intensive care units may have visiting hours restricted. They may have certain policies on food or drink. They may have policies on how many people can be in the room. Many hospitals these days have relaxed a lot of these former, more stringent responsibilities in the goal of increasing family involvement in care. You want to find out who is the unit clerk and who is the charge nurse. The charge nurse is responsible for the assignment of all nurses on the unit to individual patients. That nurse coordinates the care of all the nurses taking the supervision of all those nurses taking care of the patients. Remember, each individual nurse may take care of anywhere from 2 to 7 patients, depending on the busyness of the unit. The unit clerk is usually not a nurse, but is someone who handles most of the paperwork and the transferring of information between one system and the other, such as moving paperwork or orders from the doctor to the nurses or to another system such as radiology or the laboratory. Usually most hospitals now have a whiteboard or chalkboard in the patient's room where they'll write the name of your mother's individual nurse. A lot of hospitals now have moved towards putting phone numbers which connect to cell phones or other mobile phones that those nurses carry. The important thing to remember is once you've learned all these names, they'll change 3 times a day. Nurses usually work in 8-hour shifts. Some nurses will work double shifts, or some will work a 12-hour shift. These shifts usually change at 7 a.m., 3 p.m., and 11 p.m. At those times, visiting hours are usually restricted as well. There may be less nurses available on the evening shift, which starts at 11 p.m., so it's important to remember that those nurses may not be the greatest source of information when you have questions such as, is mom going to be sent home tomorrow? But they will be helpful if you need anything emergently. As nurses have shifts, so do doctors. And especially on a hospital medicine team, the doctors usually run a shift anywhere from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. That means the physician at midnight is not the same physician at noon. Those physicians also may change every 7 days. So if your mother is admitted on a Monday and discharged on a Friday, it is most likely that a different hospitalist will be discharging her than the one who admitted her, which makes what I'm about to say more important. You want to keep informed because you act as a point of continuity of information between all these changing healthcare providers. You want to keep up to date with what new changes in her medications and conditions have been. You also want to be an advocate for your mother during this day. The main thing is you want mom to try to walk as much as she can. There may be some circumstances where your mother should not be walking, such as if she has a blood clot in her leg or a condition with her heart. But for the most part, ask the nurse or physician if it's okay if you could help mom walk around the unit more. A lot of medical studies have shown that there are improved outcomes and a decreased likelihood of needing to be in a nursing home after discharge if you have mobility while in the hospital. Another thing I always ask my families to do is to try to encourage their mother or their loved one to sit up when eating the meals. This is important because when older persons are ill, a lot of muscles weaken, including the muscles responsible for swallowing, and could increase the risk of aspiration, which is when food goes down the wrong pipe. This leads to pneumonia. getting mom to eat her meals in at a table, sitting in a chair rather than in bed, decreases the chance of that event occurring. You also want to keep an eye on your mom for changes in condition. These may be due to medications. These may be due to a change in her disease. This may be due to a change in the environment. So if you see any of the following, let her nurse know. Increased confusion, breathing difficulties, coughing while eating or drinking, and new rashes or itching. Again, these things may point to a reaction to a medication, to a change in her condition, or something else regarding the environment that needs to be corrected. A lot of family members will often focus on other things, such as the floors don't look clean, or I didn't see the linen change today. Those are less important than these four things. Some advice I can give to family members on how to be in control. Some do's. You do want to get adequate rest and food for yourself. You are the caregiver. You are important. You will be needed not only when mother gets better, but afterwards as well. Be patient and calm. With all these changing staff members, it's very hard to know who is responsible for what. You will be the only constant besides your mother. So be her ally, be patient, and be calm. It's important to have empathy for the nurses and try not to use a demanding tone of voice. Nurses are very underappreciated in today's environment. They are very essential to patient care. They often may have more complex patients than they used to at the same amount of staffing ratio or patients they're responsible for. Try to become friends and an ally with your nurse. And try to make the care team view your mother as your mom, not as a patient with pneumonia or a patient with heart failure. It is important to emphasize her human qualities. What you don't want to do, you do want to use a firm tone, but not a demanding tone. You want to avoid focusing on the little things. And one thing that comes up often is people refusing to allow medications to be given. My advice is to question and delay, but do not outwardly refuse. So instead of saying, "Mom's not taking this medication until I speak with her doctor," try, "I understand, but can mom wait to take the medicine until the doctor is able to explain it to us?" As you can see, managing your mother's care in the hospital is quite a diplomatic feat as well. Finally, you will get to the point where mother gets better and a plan for discharge is being constructed. Again, realize that the physician coordinating this discharge may not be the physician who admitted your mother and may need to be reminded of certain things. The first thing you want is to make sure you understand what the final diagnosis from the physician is. The diagnosis given in the emergency room may not be the actual diagnosis your mother has. It is a best estimate. You want to get the most accurate one as possible. You want to call your mother's primary care doctor and already have an appointment for her to see him or her within a week of discharge. Don't depend on the hospital making that appointment for you. Be proactive and do it yourself. Ask the physician or the nurse if you need to obtain any specialist appointments and get a final medication list. Medications are important. They're one of the areas we see the most amount of errors. You want to find out any home medications that are not to be taken anymore and any new medications that have been started. You want to check to see if any generics were substituted for brand names so that you don't duplicate the same medication. You may want to show the discharging physicians the medications your mother takes to refresh their memory or to introduce them to them if they had not seen them before. Some things you want to know about before you go home are what outstanding labs, tests, x-rays, or other diagnostics are still waiting a final read or report at the time of departure. Your primary care physician will have to follow these up, but needs to know that they exist in order to do so. You also want a phone number of a contact within the group of physicians that have been taking care of your mother to call if your doctor needs more information. Finally, and this is probably the most important point, stress that you want the discharge summary sent to your mother's physician. A discharge summary is a final report by the discharge physician of all the things that happened to your mother, including the final diagnosis, any tests that were done, and any other new diagnoses that were discovered. This is the primary document for your mother's primary care doctor to understand what happened in the hospital. We'll have more detail than your memory can handle, and often more detail than your physician can handle, but is vital. make sure that the hospital physician has your mother's primary care doctor's name, address, and fax number so that they can send this document to them. Finally, there are a number of choices of places your mother can go to. She can go to a nursing home for subacute rehab. She can go to a nursing home for long-term care. She could go to acute rehab hospital. She can go to hospice, home with home health, home with hospice at home. There is a whole variety of options here. Discuss it with the team before you leave so that you understand, and don't be afraid to ask questions. Finally, if she's going home with you and you've noticed that she's become weak, don't assume that the team saw that as well. Be an advocate for your mother and say that you do need home health for her if she does show signs of weakening. Home health can send out a number of disciplines, including an occupational therapist, speech therapist, social worker, physical therapist, etc. And again, when you have the home health, you don't want to use that as a substitution for your mother seeing your doctor, her doctor, within 7 days. And that's it.
Dr. Price, that is great information. I want to commend you. You did a great job. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Price took a presentation that took an hour and condensed it to 20, 25 minutes. Great job. Before we close, there are four points that you brought up that I'd like to speak to a little bit. The first is triage. For our listening audience, Dr. Price, tell us what that is. Tell us who does it and the purpose of it.
Triage is a method of determining the severity of illness of a patient presenting to the emergency room. In extreme conditions, it is used to determine who gets immediate medical help and who gets delayed medical help. But in the emergency room these days, it's usually used to determine what setting your mother or the patient needs to be moved to. For example, if triage determines that your mother has what are called unstable vital signs, which would be a very low blood pressure, problems with receiving enough oxygen into her bloodstream, an exceedingly high fever, she may be immediately moved to what are known as intensive care bays, or immediately moved from the emergency room to an intensive care bed. Most of the time, triage will get the basic information such as your mother's blood pressure, heart rate, her temperature, her blood sugar level, and her oxygen saturation level. These will be conveyed to an emergency room nurse or physician, and then they can also help determine, okay, this patient can be seen in an hour, or this patient needs to be seen in 15 minutes. So triage is a way of trying to increase the efficiency so that more critically ill patients are seen quicker.
And in a brief list, can you tell us who the individuals that are doing the triage, who would that team compose of?
Okay. Usually, basic triage is done either by a technician or a nurse assistant. It is not usually done by a registered nurse or an advanced nurse. It's very simple to train someone how to do a triage for basic vital signs. I often train medical students how to do that. If you can train a medical student, you can train almost anyone. In our nursing home, for example, our triage is done usually by licensed practical nurses, okay, which are not an RN, but not a nursing assistant.
Okay, to clarify, then basically the triage process is going to occur probably prior to a registered nurse or a physician seeing the patient. Is that a reasonable statement?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. You also, then the second point I wanted to expand, you made the statement that you're going to be asked by a set of questions, probably the same questions over and over. I recognize that that's going to be by numerous people, probably an RN, then probably an intern, then probably a resident, and then maybe an ER physician. In my mind, obviously, the intern, resident, they're there. They're trying to expand their skills and knowledge. But why the same questions over and over again?
Well, one thing is the answers to the questions may change. So while the nurse may say after triage, how's your mother feeling? Is she throwing up? And the answer then may be no. An hour later, it may be yes. The second thing is it helps the doctors determine what the course of her illness has been. So if mother initially had chest pain and now no longer has chest pain, it gives them a time frame. The other thing is the fact that full documentation doesn't occur rapidly. So some people may want to confirm information, especially drug allergies and things that are very important not to get wrong. And I think the other thing is the fact that sometimes we're so busy, we're trying to build a rapport with people. And so some questions are easy to remember to start a conversation and to help figure out where the conversation should go next.
Yeah. The point that I want to bring forth is that many times the same question or the variations in the answers to the same question is an indication of what the course of treatment should be.
Yeah. Correct. Yes.
Okay, good. All right. The next point, you talked about ER physicians. And you made a statement about what they are supposed to be doing during this ER visit. Speak to that. What are they trying to do with the patient at that point?
An ER physician is a very interesting physician because ER physicians are simultaneously managing multiple patients. So an ER physician in an hour may be seeing patients for 3/4 of that hour, but are not seeing the same patient for that 3/4. They may be seeing 4 or 5 patients. They stagger their initial interviews and exams to coincide with simultaneously running diagnostic tests to get a picture of the changing situation. But also they have to be efficient enough to manage multiple people. These days, emergency rooms tend to be crowded. And we know that is a fact. And it's an unfortunate side effect of some of the ways our healthcare system has responded to the environment. But the physician, when they're not seeing your mother or not seeing your loved one, that doesn't mean they're not still working on the case. Often we sit down at a computer to read more information or talk to the radiologist to find out what did the x-ray look like, or go down to radiology ourselves to look at that x-ray ourselves and then come back.
Yeah, I have personal experience with this, but even if there were no lines or no people waiting in the ER, you bring your mother there, there's going to be downtime while the tests are being run, being read, being examined, consultation. There's going to be time when no one's in the room virtually. There's going to be downtime.
Right. Some rough estimates, for example, a blood count will take anywhere from 20 to 30 minutes run as an emergent test. A CAT scan can take anywhere from 30 minutes to an hour to have interpreted. If it's an emergency one, we can probably read it a little faster. You know, the quickest lab results I get back are actually called a blood gas, which are 5 minutes, but not everything runs like that. So you're talking things take 10 minutes or longer on average, and the more tests that are ordered, the longer it will take.
Yeah, just by nature of our medical field, this is going to take some time, and people have to understand that the emergency room visit is going to be an hour, 2 hours, regardless.
Now, doctor, you mentioned that several people are going to be checking in on your mother during this process. Is there ever a time when these several people kind of get together and brainstorm what's happening and to kind of, as a group, come to some conclusion rather than having a half a dozen individuals look at an elephant and not know what it is when together they might be able to figure it out all at once?
Yeah, that's a good point. And what people don't see is the constant communication between different members of the emergency room staff. The emergency room nurse is almost always in constant contact with the emergency room physician. The emergency physician may be in intermittent contact with the radiologist or the laboratory. And it's a continually flowing dance, if you will. You also find points where they'll all come together as a team, especially around the time that a shift is changing, to discuss everyone that's there and go through who needs what done. You may not be able to see this, but as physicians, we see this. There's actually, in most emergency rooms, a running board, which shows the patient's name, what tests are being run, when they're anticipated to be back, and what is the time till the next intervention has to be done. So there actually is computerized coordination as well.
That's great. The last point I want you to clarify, and this really is not new to me, but it certainly struck me, and that's the specialist that is called a hospitalist. When I was actively involved in healthcare and acute care, many of these same functions were done by family physicians. That's no longer the case. Talk to us about that change.
Well, I think that change really started happening at the beginning of the 21st century. Around 1998, 1999, we started to see this become an emerging trend. I think in the Atlanta area, it really became more obvious around 2002. And what that basically became was that physicians decided that their practice model they wanted was to just work in the hospital. They liked the challenge, they liked the environment, and so they started forming groups. When the primary care doctors realized that they had people who had more experience dealing with patients in the hospital setting, who had were starting to develop a discipline of focusing on the quality of care delivered in the hospital setting, they became more comfortable deferring care of their patients when they had to be admitted to these physicians. And these physicians have advanced to the point where they have a national society, they have a national voice, and they're extremely valuable to the healthcare industry as well as the patient care in general. You're talking about people who have immense amounts of experience handling stuff that primary care physicians may only see 10 times a year. These people may have seen 10 in the last week.
Yeah. And you and I were talking before the show. They see it so often, and I know for a fact you see things so often, you become very, very efficient in examining and treating that just by repetition.
Yes, yes. A hospitalist giving a physical exam may be an immensely focused, mainly because the fact is that they have this immense amount of experience, and I think there's some comfort in that. I think that most people get confused because their perception or expectations of what a physician is not what what a physician's job looked like 20 years ago.
Exactly.
It's changed so radically that most people, I think, develop some stress because it's so unfamiliar. It's nothing like it is on TV, for example. But I think that once you understand what the environment has become, you realize that there are some advantages to this. There are some disadvantages. What we've talked about today basically is how to act as a coordinator between all these different members of the care team. But the advantages are that we now have a discipline that focuses on improving outcomes of patients who've been in the hospital and reducing the rate of them having to come back to the hospital.
Yeah, and that really segues right into the last point where you made that the family member care/caregiver needs to be the continuity or facilitate the continuity of information. And if you take out of the equation the family physician, then you can clearly understand why that's an important role.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. Because I think that we as healthcare consumers have basically, we became lazy because we figured our primary care doctor would know everything. And those days are over. We have to take more responsibility for our own healthcare, including our record of healthcare. And so there are myriad computer programs on iPhones and computers that you can track your own healthcare database and keep it as a record that you can print out a copy for and give to a physician. And I see a lot of patients doing that these days.
And I'm going to, you just said it, I'm going to jump on that. In a previous life, you know, as you and I spoke, I managed care. And one of our biggest complaints 20 years ago was no repository of information. We all say, yeah, we need it. But no one wanted to acquiesce to where some big computer had all this information. Now, with the advance of technology, we can carry that information on a handheld where we only have access and no one else does. Good point. Dr. Price, we certainly appreciate it. I think this is great. The listeners can tell by the inflection of my voice how pleased I am and excited, and I appreciate you being our guest. I'd like to ask one final question. If we have someone out there listening who's facing a possible inpatient stay, give us that golden nugget of information that they might need.
Well, I really think it's emphasizing the need of the hospital physician communicating with the primary care physician. The primary method is, as I've mentioned, was the discharge summary. But any information you can glean and record and bring to your primary care physician is key. I've been on both ends, both the sending end and the receiving end, and it is extremely frustrating being on the receiving end and having no clue what has happened. I make it a personal priority for myself to keep in touch with all my patients' primary care physicians when they're in rehabilitation or in the hospital to make sure that they know you know, hey, Mrs. So-and-so has been admitted, or hey, we're going to discharge her. Here's what I need done in the next week. Here's what's still going on. And just that simple note, it doesn't take a lot of time, is enough to usually keep everyone on the same page. But as a family member, as a caregiver, you need to be empowered to realize that you can do this as well. You can help this happen.
That's great. For our listeners that might want to contact the Division of Geriatric Medicine at Emory University, how can they do that?
Well, we have an intake line for our outpatient clinic where we have many very well-respected, very well-trained geriatric physicians who can see patients as well as offer consultation. The phone number is 404-728-6363. And if there's any other questions you have, they can help you go to the appropriate answering party.
Dr. Price, great information. I can envision a time in the near future that we'd have you back on the show and explore and develop some of these other topics. Thanks for being our guest.
Thank you.
That's it for today. Great show. Just want to remind our guests who were with us, if they want to listen to a rebroadcast of today's show, they can do so at eugeriaradio.com. I thank Dr. Price. I thank our guest in Dallas for being with us. And in closing, as always, if the youth of our nation is its greatest national resource, it goes without saying that the seniors of this nation is its greatest national treasure. Thank you and God bless.
Eugeria Radio is sponsored by Griswold Special Care and broadcast live from the Business Radio X studios.